Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program today, the latest in health and healing, and how, well, those high glycemic foods, you know, the sweet foods and dairy together lead to what? You'll be surprised. If you are a person helping someone with Alzheimer's, and at the same time they're taking statin drugs, not good. I'll explain why. A real in-depth look at oregano. It is quite simply one of the most miraculous of the herbs that we can use, and I believe since it's so easy to grow, that it'd be kind of fun for you to grow them. Also, do you know why so many people have peanut allergies today? I'll give you the latest on that. And another reason to drink green tea. We have a lot to share. From our environmental segment, I want to share this with you. This is from a major study, as presented by Bruce Melton of Truthout. The worst drought in 1,000 years could begin real soon. And why? And what is the likely outcome? And there's a whole lot of people who have brought together this information. So we should pay attention to this. Then from our commentaries today, the Obama era, liberal fascism in America, by Norman Pollack, Counterpunch. Is the dietitian's trade group in bed with the junk food industry? Duh, you think so? I'll tell you about that on our program today. And also from Norman Solomon, Congress, end endless war and stop becoming the evil that we deplore. 14 defining characteristics of fascism by Gregory Palin, and reports about the shale gas that's going all over the place. Well, there's new information from Steam Horn that you can use to fight that as well. We have so much to cover. No guest today, so let us begin. Almost 90 million Americans suffer from either pre- or diabetic conditions. And that could be dysinsulinism. They either have too high or too low blood sugar. They have a kind of a roller coaster. They'll take some coffee with sugar or have a soft drink, and their energy kind of picks up for about 5 minutes. But then the blood sugar comes down and crashes below the normal threshold, and then you end up with a fatigue. And then to get out of the fatigue, you take something else that gets the sugar back in the system. It's really a bad situation. But there's something else that happens when we're on these high glycemic foods and consume dairy. According to the Journal of the American Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, you end up with acne. That's from Science Daily. Now, when you consider that we have well over 17 million Americans suffering from acne, and acne influences quality of life and for some people causes social withdrawal and anxiety and depression. So this is one way that we can help people. Sugar, fat, and dairy. That's the primary causes. That was done at research at the Department of Nutrition and Food Studies and Public Health at the New York University. Now, there are millions of Americans who suffer from Alzheimer's, but worse than that, there are tens of millions of Americans suffering from memory loss, generally short-term memory loss. And you'll notice, here's one of the ways you'll tell if someone has short-term memory loss. They will mention the same comments once or two or three times in the same conversation, but they won't remember that they had just told you the same thing. That is a red flag. And when you see that, and you see it on a regular basis, people repeating themselves, that's generally short-term memory loss. Now, that means that they have advanced aging in the brain. They have plaque formations in the brain. They have broken dendrites in the brain that allow signals to go from one cell, one neuron, to another. And that leads them into dementia. And then from dementia, it leads them into Alzheimer's. I have several people that I know and have known for a long time who now have dementia. And the trouble is, they can't remember that they have just said something. They can't remember what they have forgotten. So you'll talk with them, they say, I didn't say that. And unless you have a tape recorder and say, look, you just said this three times. And then they kind of get it. Otherwise, it's very hard for them to process this. So a lot of the people with memory loss also have elevated cholesterol. And for that in America, most people take, unfortunately, statins. This is from Dr. John Briefa, Health Impact News. I'll quote it. It says, many years ago, I was having dinner with a friend who was herself a young hospital doctor specializing in care of the elderly, which is what was called geriatrics. She worked in a busy department and lamented the fact that so many elderly people were suffering from what she believed to be the adverse effects of what she termed polypharmacy, basically the taking of multiple medications. She told me that when a new patient was admitted to her ward, she would usually stop all medications and then might re-add them very selectively later. She said the stopping of all medications very commonly led to a significant improvement in the clinical state of her patients, which is why she did it. This conversation came back to me this week while I was reading a study in which elderly individuals with Alzheimer's disease had their statin medication stopped for 6 weeks and then restarted. The results, in short, showed that during the 6 weeks when their statins were stopped, the basic brain function in the individuals improved. And when the drugs were restarted, brain function got worse again. Now, one could argue that this sort of study is not necessarily a good judge of the impact of statins on brain function. That's because the researchers and patients knew when the patients were taking statins and when they were off, which means the changes might be down to the placebo response or even bias on the part of the researchers. I would say that, in many respects, this study is a pretty decent judge of how things work in the real world. If a person feels better and seems brighter once their statin is stopped, then whether this has to do with the placebo response or not, it seems reasonable to consider stopping the medication in the long term. Some researchers have suggested that statins might actually improve brain function in the elderly. This stance is largely theoretical, and studies in which individuals have been given statins have not found that they improve brain function at all. Actually, last year, the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S. issued a warning about the potential for statins to affect brain function, telling us, quote, there have been rare post-marketing reports of cognitive impairment, memory loss, forgetfulness, amnesia, memory confusion associated with statin use. Well, these reported symptoms are generally not serious and reversible upon statin discontinuation, which might take, up to 3 weeks. I'm pleased to see these studies get published. And that's this medical doctor. Now, something we can all do for ourselves is we can include more culinary herbs into our diet. They could help us with functional health, meaning they actually do something good in the body. Elizabeth Renter from the Natural Society has come up with a list of things that oregano does, and having used oregano with individuals I counsel on a regular basis, I can attest to the good science behind this. And by the way, remember, oregano is an old herb. It was used in Greece. It was used in Rome. They would actually wear laurels of organic on their heads to celebrate at their nuptials, and it was supposed to provide good health. Well, it does. So what do we actually know about oregano that's medically verifiable? Well, here's what we know. The oil of oregano, like thymol and carvacrol, inhibit the growth of bacteria, including Staphylococcus aureus. And there was a study that found oregano to be more successful at treating the bacterial infections Giardia lamblia than the antibiotic most commonly prescribed for the ailment. It also was able to combat E. coli and Salmonella, which is a major foodborne pathogen. It actually helps with weight loss because of converting an amount of, let's say, oregano oil that we need in the body in a way that promotes a healthy metabolism. It can help with digestion. In fact, there was a journal of experimental and toxicological pathogens showed how oregano oil can benefit a number of systems within the body. It can help eliminate colitis in this laboratory experiment, improve colon and liver health. It helps with sinus infection. Just steaming some hot water and putting some oregano oil on it and then inhaling that water with your eyes closed could help with sinus infections. Oregano oil can also be combined with other healing agents for a toothache if the result is done intelligently, and I've seen that happen. But it also, so let's just see, oregano and oregano oil is antibacterial. It's a very powerful antioxidant. It's antifungal. I frequently have people who might have athlete's feet or maybe a fungus toenail, and I have them apply oregano oil at night over the nail and then wrap it with the gauze and keep it on with a sock. It's anti-inflammatory. It's antihistamine, which is great for treating allergies. It soothes skin ailments. It fights respiratory illness. It treats your lungs. It soothes muscle aches and pains. It lessens menstrual cramps. And it's immune booster. So all that from oregano oil. There was a time when you just didn't find very many Americans who had any allergies to peanuts. So why so many Americans today are allergic to peanuts? Well, a Dr. Tim O'Shea has an idea, and it's worth considering. He believes, according to Jonathan Benson, that it's peanut oil in vaccines. That's right. There are more than a million children living in America today suffering from peanut allergy, and many of them can't go very far without some kind of injectable epinephrine, just in case they had accidentally become exposed to peanuts. And how this happened, since we had virtually no peanut allergies prior to 1900, and that's where Dr. O'Shea comes in. He argues that vaccines are largely responsible for both the advent and increased prevalence of peanut allergy, noting that many vaccines and even antibiotic drugs contain excipients derived from peanut oil. And since it's a relatively inexpensive oil to produce, refined peanut oil becomes widely adopted as an excipient of choice in the production of vaccines, especially during the 1960s, and is still widely used today for this purpose. But peanut oil's role in triggering the peanut allergy epidemic we see today cannot go unstated, as its introduction at the turn of the 20th century and eventually caused a sudden, very apparent wave of anaphylaxis, which had never before been seen. And, of course, this audience knows that anaphylaxis is the general term used to denote allergic reactions to food and can include severe and sometimes violent reactive symptoms, convulsions, seizures, even death. So the more peanut oil was used in vaccines and drug production, it turns out the more the population began to suffer from serious food allergy symptoms, and using peanut oil as an excipient for what was great for the drug and vaccine industries, of course, as it works as an effective preservative and adjuvant for vaccines. But for those who ingest or are injected with it, peanut oil-based excipients and adjuvants can be the precipitator of a large variety of problems. Now, let's say that you have Alzheimer's, or know someone, of course, who does. One new thing you can do to help them is green tea. Perhaps there's no beverage that benefits a person with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and ALS and multiple sclerosis more than green tea. And it has a lot of anti-aging effects. It promotes cardiovascular health. It protects against diabetes. It reverses chronic fatigue syndrome. And it has strong anti-cancer properties. So new research published in the Journal of Biological Chemistry has determined that EGCG is able to stop amyloid beta proteins from attaching to and killing brain cells in a lab setting. Now, these amyloid beta proteins are considered a leading contributor to Alzheimer's disease. And this particular study was done in vitro, which means in a glass petri dish or test tubes, but not in animals or humans. And the study was performed by research at the University of Leeds in the UK, and it had very positive effects. So here's what we know. Here's the takeaway message about green tea. It promotes weight loss. It helps reverse coronary artery disease. It enhances the function of brain cells for senior citizens. It helps relieve chronic fatigue. It induces programmed cell death, apoptosis, in people with cancer. It helps minimize HIV viral loads. It offers protection against chronic inflammation. It does all this. And, of course, it boosts the immune system. All that is good. Now, finally, from our health segment today, reasons to try organic sulfur. Now, of course, when you eat garlic, you're getting sulfur. Onions, you're getting sulfur. There's a lot of things you can consume that give sulfur. There's a lot of nutrients that contain sulfur. Well, Hesh Goldstein of Natural News came up with some really interesting ones. I just wanted to share them with you because I believe these could help us prevent colds and flu. I believe it could help strengthen your immune system. Really important if, like myself, you're out on the road a lot and traveling, and especially the millions of Americans who fly on a regular basis. Flight attendants, business people, commuters who use airplanes, and, of course, pilots. All of them are getting more background radiation. That's a bad thing. And the more you get, the more susceptible you become to cancers and immune dysregulation. So sulfur can help. First, remember, sulfur is not a drug. It's not a prescription medication. It's a natural nutrient, and your body thrives on it. It increases enzyme production within the glands, and that helps prevent illness. And women who are going through perimenopause and menopause, it's really beneficial. It increases flexibility in the tissue within the body. It increases blood circulation. It reduces muscle and joint inflammation and promotes healing in the muscles and the joints, such as arthritis and fibromyalgia. If you're an athlete, it can help you overcome soreness and recover and return to normality is quickened. It eliminates a lot of free radicals. And we know those free radicals attack the cells and promote cell DNA destruction, which speeds up the death process. It promotes increased growth of hair and fingernails. One of the very first things I do when I sit across from someone who's got thinning, graying, and lusterless hair, and brittle, and cracked, and little nails, I look at this and I say, "Tell me what you eat." And almost always, they have very little sulfur going into the body. So it's one of the very first things I give them, a lot of food and supplements that have sulfur. And it promotes rejuvenation of hair and fingernails. And because of the oxygenation of the cells and tissues, the body is kept in a constant aerobic environment, which is making it so that the cancer cells have a harder time existing. It helps prevent osteoporosis. It helps with all your brain diseases, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. It increases skin health and helps minimize wrinkles. It helps regulate insulin, great for diabetics. It helps alleviate chronic headaches and migraines. It increases circulation in the brain cells and promote proper brain circulation. That's very important. And let's face it, less pressure and pain result, reducing in less headaches. It helps alleviate emphysema, and it's great for the cell walls in the lungs. It has the ability to make cell walls more permeable, and that causes the body to rapidly release and reduce alcohol toxins, removing them as waste from the body. That's why anyone who ever has a hangover, anyone who's drank alcohol, I put them on a 24-hour high sulfur intake. It helps to reduce and often eliminate diverticulitis and parasites living in the intestine, which are not as apt to attach to the walls due to the slippery coating that the OS produces. And because of this, hatching parasitic worms are frequently flushed out before they can attach to the walls. And it reduces hypoglycemia in the body and helps alleviate PMS. Remember, glandular production is enhanced by a sulfur. So just some of the things that we should be paying attention to that makes a big difference. And by the way, for anyone who has an autistic or Asperger suffering child, lots of sulfur makes a big difference. I'm Gary Noll, and that's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Let's go to some of the areas of our environmental issues. This is from Bruce Meldon, Truth Out. Worst drought in 1,000 years could begin in 8 years or sooner. We could see permanent climate conditions across the North American Southwest that are comparable to the worst mega droughts in 1,000 years. The latest research from the Lamont-Daughtry Earth Observatory at Columbia University, published just 2 months ago, has some truly astonishing news. The mega droughts, referred to in the paper published in Nature Climate Change, happened around 1300 AD and are so extreme that they have no modern counterpart for comparison. And some people might call them the 12th century mega drought. The research was funded by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. Now, this audience knows that I've been warning for at least the last 10 years that we could be facing mega droughts if we did not pay attention to the basics. In fact, I mentioned I'm working on a documentary called the 12 tipping points. Well, four of those tipping points have tips, and there's nothing we're going to do about it. We simply have to be aware of the consequences to us if we don't pay attention. Now, unfortunately, when we all had a chance to do something positive about climate change, we didn't. In fact, industry didn't. The White House, every White House from Clinton on, chose not to. Congress chose not to. The EPA chose not to. Most of the environmental groups in America that are just nothing more than nice, cushiony places for highly advanced, best and brightest technocrats did nothing. And the few people at the grassroots level who finally have awakened don't quite know what to do. Going to the mall on a Sunday when the offices are closed and holding up posters praising President Obama. Well, you missed it. Wrong message, wrong time. Then go home and ask yourself, how much of the stuff that you have and consume is contributing to the very problem that you're concerned about? It really starts with a greater and deeper spiritual consciousness. So according to this report, we're not only talking about how bad this mega drought's going to be, and this is only one of four climate scenarios, all of them bad to the bone. But this is also going to be on top of the current droughts that we currently have. This is superimposed on top of the mega drought. That means extreme. So in lay language, what does this mean? What do I see? Here's what I see. I see that due to our current drought, I see due to our current extreme weather patterns of excessive rain, excessive sun, excessive cold, excessive snow. These are excessive, but they're all caused by the same underlying climate change phenomena. That these are only going to get worse. So we will have hotter days and colder days, but we won't have as much snow over a longer period of time. So you'll have one big snowstorm or two big snowstorms, but that's not enough to create enough snowpack to sustain a slow melt. Here's how it works. If you've gone up into the high Rockies, which is a beautiful place to go. In fact, if you go up on my website, GaryNoll.com or ProgressiveRadarNetwork.com, I put up there photographs of about 8 or 9 different wilderness quests that I do. I just go out with some water and spend a week in nature someplace. Now, just these are just showing you some of the places I've chosen the last 10 years, the latest just being this last year. And generally, what you'll see is for about 7 months a year, there's snow going up the mountains. And then during the winter, warmer weather, it begins to melt, and the lower snowpacks melt. And then as the season goes on, more and more melts. And the largest snow melts are in the spring, and that's why you have all your streams full and your rapids roiling and things bursting to life. And then you have less in July, and then very little in September or October, and then it's August, and then it's really dry in September. And then in the late fall, the snows come again and repacked again. That's the normal cycle. Now, when that snow melts, it also feeds streams and tributaries that farmers have historically used to pull that water in and help irrigate their farmland. Even in some areas, the lower deltas, flooding the land, but when it floods, it brings all that mineral-rich material and leaves it behind, much like the Nile, in the Nile Delta. After the floods every year, the soils re-energize. It's been rebooted with all the necessary nutrients to have wonderful crops that they can grow, whether it's cotton or whatever they're choosing to grow. All that's changed now. So now you're not getting that sustained snowpack. And where there is snow, it's generally a lot at one time, and then it's gone. So now, as the sun hits the snowpack, it bounces back into the solar system. Not a problem. But when the snow isn't packed up on the mountain and isn't dense, then the sun hits the rock and it warms the rock. And as the rock is warm and holds the heat, it radiates upwards, which means that more snow melts faster than what it should. And then that means that you've got more runoff. So what you're having is you're having torrential flooding, too much water being released at one time. But then that's not good because then the rock doesn't bounce back the sunlight. Like ice on the Arctic Ocean bounces it back. But when the ice pack melts, the sunlight goes through the water, which is not very deep. It's only about 500 feet, hits the bottom and warms it up. That allows trapped methane gases that have been trapped for thousands of years to be released, and that percolates up, and now you have tens of thousands of these methane percolated areas of the Arctic. That creates the global warming. It becomes a self-reinforcing negative event. Now, we could have stopped all this, but those in control of industries that did not want to alter their profit stream by, let's say, putting money into making their products safer, like coal power plants, for example, and manufacturing plants, they bought the think tanks, they staffed it with technocrats that do their bidding. They then funded PAC groups and got political loyalty on their side, and they control both the Democrat and Republican side of the issue. So people might say they're concerned about the environment, but they're not going to do anything about it. So we've done nothing. So now that we've done nothing, and I mean nothing, it was with intent that we did nothing. So now what has happened is it's tipped. So look at Kansas, Illinois, Indiana, South Dakota, North Dakota. Look at our breadbasket states. Look further over. Look at Idaho for potatoes and Iowa. And look at all those, about 12 states. They're not going to be able to produce what they did in the past. Also, the aquifer they're using is running out of water. And with more and more people being congested in that area, they're going to run out of it sooner. Then you have states like Nevada, New Mexico, most of Texas, at least half of California or more, at least half of Colorado, and Oklahoma. They're not going to be able to sustain themselves. They're going to have excessive heat, too little water. With you have permanent drought, you're going to have permanent fires. And how are you going to support the people, industries, and communities living there if you don't have the resources? So once they use the common resources and once they pumped everything they can out of the common aquifers, then they'll start going to private aquifers. And then the treaties that they have had in force for a long period of time, where the water goes from the, you know, the little Colorado and the Hoover Dam and Lake Mead and all these other places that have been principally where the water comes from, they're going to drown down to nothing. They're going to go out. So then Mexico and many other places just not going to get the water. So you're going to have one day, and it will all be denied until the crisis is upon people, because that's the way the political animals in our society, and there are no other. That's how they operate. They're terrified to tell the truth to the people because they don't want to be accused of causing a panic. And they also know that if they told the truth, hey, friends, you're living in a non-sustainable area. So isn't it time you looked in a reasonable and responsible way to move to a more sustainable area? Then someone's going to say, but those people move, the value of the property drops, the real estate rolls go down, the taxes that we pay, our civil servants, our state and local budgets dry up. You know, you've just created an exodus. That person will commit political suicide if they did that. So they're not going to do it. They'll keep getting reports and studies. And anytime you're getting more reports and studies, just remember, that's really double speak for we know the real problem. But as long as we tell the public that we're studying it with experts, no one's going to be the wiser. So that's what happens. And so one day you'll wake up and you will have already gone from being able to water your lawn once every 2 weeks to not watering your lawn at all. You will be monitored by the amount of water that you put in your into your house. There'll be water meters that will automatically shut off the water at a particular maximum usage. So for people that are used to, turning on a faucet and getting all the water they want, that's not going to happen in the future in these places. And that means that when people finally, and angry and resistant, as if, why didn't I know? And, well, you can say, did you want to know? How much of the truth do you want to know about anything in life? Then they'll move, but where are they going to go? More often than not, they're just going to go to more congested areas, which are going to further deplete those resources. And those moving towards the oceans, think twice. We should not build any of the homes destroyed by hurricanes on the water or the buildings because they're just going to be destroyed again. Now, that's a bitter pill also to swallow, but it's one we have to start facing. Better that we help these people between their homeowners insurance and the federal insurance to relocate people so that they could rebuild their home in a safe environment, because the ocean is coming up. The warmer the water gets, heat expands water. It's a basic fact of chemistry. So just imagine 2 billion gallons of water every day out of the 104 nuclear power reactors in the United States. That in itself is a rather substantial way of increasing the heat of the water. But then you have global warming, which has dwarfed that. And so you're going to have more and more water expanding ever further, which increases the velocity of storms and storm surges. So at least the entire Long Island shore, the Jersey shore, and the tributaries around Manhattan and lower Manhattan will not be sustainable in the near future. It may take another 5 years. It may take another two or three superstorms until finally even the most dim-witted politicians, are there any others, and the most resistant to truth citizens, that's the majority, will finally wake up one day and say, oh my God, you know, what just happened? Well, friend, you know, everything has changed. So I'm just giving you the idea there are places in America where you're just not going to be able to have a quality of life. So pay attention. I wrote an article, The Most Sustainable Places on the Planet, Where to Live, where you won't be in these problems, where you won't be near a nuclear power plant, or you won't be in a drought zone. Or take a look at it. It's there and it's free. Now, finally, on the environmental segment, I shared with you in the last, it was in the last about 14 months, why I'm against gas hydrofracking. And I gave you all the reasons, all the use of all this water that we should be using for humans and not for them, the fact that it's causing earthquakes, the fact that it is polluting the air and it can pollute streams and rivers and aquifers and people's drinking water and devalues their land. So the truth of what people are actually getting when they sign a lease, if they knew the full truth, you wouldn't have anyone really signing leases. But there was another problem I have. As you know, I predicted the real estate bubble. I predicted five bubbles a year before any of the bubbles happened. I predicted a credit card bubble, a commercial real estate bubble, a home equity bubble, a hedge fund, and a equity partnership bubble. Here's the latest bubble. I had predicted this four times. I'm not alone now. This is from Energy Policy Forum plus Post Carbon Institute. Quote, shale gas bubble looms, aided by Wall Street. I'll quote it verbatim. Two long-awaited reports were published today at shalebubble.org by the Post Carbon Institute and Energy Policy Forum. Together, the reports conclude that the hydraulic fracturing, meaning fracking, boom, could lead to a bubble burst akin to the housing bubble burst of 2008. While most media attention towards fracking has focused on the threats to drinking water and health in communities throughout North America and the world, there's an even larger threat looming. The fracking industry has the ability, paralleling the housing bubble burst that served as a precursor to the 2008 economic crisis, to tank the global economy. Playing the role of Cassandra, the reports conclude, quote, the so-called shale revolution is nothing more than a bubble. Let me repeat that. Quote, the so-called shale revolution is nothing more than a bubble driven by record levels of drilling, speculative lease and flip practices on the part of the shale energy companies, fee-driven promotion by the same investment banks that fomented the housing bubble. Geological and economic constraints, not to mention the very serious environmental and health impacts of drilling, mean that shale gas and shale oil, tight oil, are far from the solutions to our energy woes. End quote. The report is titled Drill Baby Drill, and it's offered by the Post Carbon Institute fellow and former oil and gas industry geoscientist J. David Hughes. So, wasn't it President Obama who just said in his union address that the fracking industry's favorite mantra, there are 100 years of natural gas sitting beneath us? Quote, we have a supply of natural gas that can last America nearly 100 years, and my administration will take every possible action to safely develop this energy? Well, as everything that comes out of Washington. It's wrong. Hughes concludes that, quote, the 100 years trope serves as a disinformation smokescreen, and at current production rates, they're at best 25 years under the surface. Industry proponents rely on a figure known as technically recoverable reserves when they promote the potential of shale basins. The figure that actually matters, though, is production rates, or what the wells actually pull out of the reserves when fracking. In the case of U.S. shale gas, the book reserves are operating on what Hughes coins a drilling treadmill, suffering from the law of diminishing returns. In fact, here's the truth, and here's something that no one in Washington wants you to know. Hughes analyzed the industry's production data of 65,000 wells from 31 shale basins nationwide using the a database widely used both by the industry and the U.S. government. He sums up the quagmire he discovered in doing this. Quote, this is interesting. Wells experience severe rates of depletion. This steep rate of depletion requires a frenetic pace of drilling to offset declines. Roughly 7,200 new shale gas wells need to be drilled every year at a cost of over $42 billion simply to maintain current levels of production. And as the most productive well locations are drilled first, it's likely that drilling rates and costs will only increase as time goes on, end quote. The reality, he explains, is that five shale gas basins currently produce 80% of the U.S. gas shale bounty, and those five are all in steep production rate decline. And the shale oil? More the same. Over 80% of the oil produced and marketed comes from two basins, Texas's Eagle Ford Shale and North Dakota's Bakken Shale, both of which are visible from outer space satellites. Quote, taken together, shale gas and light oil require 8,600 wells per year at a cost of over $40 billion to offset declines. Tight oil production is projected to peak in 2017 at 2.3 million barrels a day and taper off. Short tight oil production from these plays will be a bubble of about 10 years duration. And he says, at current production rates, Hughes concludes there is about 5 billion barrels of shale oil located underneath the Bakken and Eagle Ford, which equates to a measly 10 months worth of oil at current runaway climate change causing oil U.S. Oil consumption rates. So, there's a giant bubble, and those who got in early were smart enough to figure out how to flip it all and get out. Those who got in later are going to get creamed, and those who are leasing their wells, well, your property's just going to be a mess, and your health will be a mess if you live near it, or your animals are going to get sick. So, the politicians were given money or promises of jobs, or they're just stupid. And the public, well, the average person just doesn't want to know about any of this. All they want to know is they turn on the water tap and they get their water. They go to the gas station. They get their gas or diesel. And they don't want to know anything beyond that. Unfortunately, not knowing that we're in a bubble means that when the bubble crashes, and it will crash. It will. There's going to be enormous economic downturn to that. Now for our commentary, then we're going to take your calls. This is important. This is a continuation of our series on understanding fascism in America. Is liberal fascism a misnomer? Perhaps Sinclair Lewis's antecedent question is more basic. Can it happen here? Fascism comes in several varieties without losing its distinctive structural, ideological, political features, all of which point to a hierarchical societal framework characterized by extremes of wealth and power, a system of government authority. Its opaqueness, shielding it from accountability in both domestic and foreign policy, and because of its secrecy, the ability to hide its disconnection from the public interest. as, for example, a dereliction of responsibility to the working class in terms of job creation, the preservation of the social safety net, and adequate funding for public education. And meanwhile, able as well to hide its connection rather to ruling groups and upper social strata through beneficial economic and fiscal policies and subsidies and the wider geopolitical strategies for wealth accumulation in international affairs and the protective cover of military strength and the involvement to preserve order and the marital spirit at home and trade and investment opportunities abroad, ensuring the resultant generation of wealth will not be channeled inward to democratize the social order. Prevention of the democratic principles at home, unilateral exercise of dominance on all major indices, a power and broad counter-revolutionary posture abroad, pretty well sums up the paradigm of fascism in a skeletal form, its methods varying to suit historical circumstances and cultural taste, and repression in some cases, and persuasion of a promotion of false consciousness in others, so long as the basic objectives are served. And what are they? Well, let's just take a look. What do all of us experience every single day when we look towards Washington or the major national media or their spokespersons? All we are served: inequality, secrecy, militarism. And by the way, under Obama, brought to fruition via the warm glow of the perfect rhetorical liberalism candidate. Liberal fascism is an elusive historical formation. Instead of goose-stepping automatons and gas chambers and Stoica dive bombers, the bombastic leader, well, all is normality on display, although to be sure some traces of the neoliberal variety of fascism remains. For goose-steppers, substitute the seemingly more innocuous militarization of the total culture under constant reinforcement. For gas chambers, substitute the structural reinforcement of gun violence, incarceration of an underclass, surveillance of everyone all the time, and you have an expeditious social control outlet. For the Stoicus, we actually go one better with armed drones for targeted assassination, directed to terrorizing, as did the Stukas, along with the closer analog buzz bombs, whole populations. And for the bombastic leader, we have the reformer, blithely at work in planning and executing assassinations, smiling all the while, and now advertising fireplace hangouts in a phony effort to imitate FDR's fireside chats. Even were large numbers of individuals the victims of political murder abstracted from the record, there would still be ample grounds for treating the presidential context as the flourishing of liberal fascism. Militarism, beyond drones, beyond the global network of bases, beyond extravagant budgets and exotic weaponry, beyond expanding the role of the CIA operatives, beyond the Pacific First strategy of enlarging the U.S. presence in Asia and containment of China, is alive and well in the Obama White House through a grand design of permanent war carried on largely by paramilitary forces with the heavy hitters, the supercarriers in the background, and the modernized nuclear weapons gently out of sight. Still, liberal fascism requires more, given that America has been in the business of counter-revolutionary militarism and intervention for some time, as it has through the government business interpretation in support of monopolism and economic consolidation generally. Get big or get out. Now, the intensification of previous key trends was still less protest than perhaps at any time since 1933. In broadest terms, listen carefully, people, America has absorbed its own negativity. And by America, I mean a culmination of tendencies towards the systematic integration of capitalism, now at a mature stage of development and correlative mechanisms of support, starting with the bludgeoning of a radical political consciousness through several decades of applied public and private pressures towards conformity. Shape up, get in line, be a good Democrat, be a good liberal, be a good conservative, be a good Republican, or there'll be a consequence. Let us internalize boundaries of acceptable doctrine and modes of protest. And that is what you saw Sunday at what I consider an absurd rally in Washington with Bill McKibben. Sorry, Bill, it's time to get real. Having all those placards supporting President Obama, having Van Jones, who was proud to have worked in the White House, and that is supposed to somehow send a message to a president who already has his agenda, sorry, it doesn't line with yours. The Keystone Pipeline will be approved. Mark my words on it. That meeting meant nothing. That's how controlled we have become. Obama can begin from where the long-term formation of a dissipative consciousness leaves off, extolling change as the formula for acquiescence, submission to authority, war, assassination, bank bailouts, military budgets, whatever it takes to keep the ship of state and monopoly capitalism on course. But why liberal? Because rhetoric trumps reality in everything we do in America. Everything. No exception. And the attachment of leader and led is bound up in an apolitical moral vacuum affecting each, although resistant to critical thinking and analysis. Yet more, liberalism has itself demonstrated its bankruptcy, as when, for example, a majority of the American people support the armed drone program. Assassination is cost-effective in protecting America from the nefarious other. Whether we had created the conditions of international hostility to the United States is unthinkable. Better to plot ahead, draw together in classless harmony, celebrate America as the land of opportunity, as societal dislocation proceeds apace, whether unemployment, foreclosures, renditions, torture, non-regulation, crumbling infrastructure, gun rampages, or presidential papering over of war crimes, wealth concentration, and destruction of the environment. Don't have critical discussions on it. Under the liberal banner, the U.S. ventured into the Cold War arena. Its anti-communism became a spacious umbrella for sacrificing dissent on the altar of respectability, so that by the 1960s, at the latest, liberalism should have been, but was not, detached from being more anti-radical than progressive. Obama could have stepped forward two decades earlier without missing a beat from a policy, if not radical, standpoint, and his conservatizing thrust has now touched race, with blacks in prominent positions firmly installed in the Praetorian Guard of vested interest. Ah, but Mr. President, I can tell you this. Neither the great Paul Robeson nor Dr. Martin Luther King would ever be admissible in the political culture that you run today. Liberalism has been a chief containment of democratic theory and practice, joined at the hip to a Democratic Party solicitous of Wall Street and a whole flock of interest-defining predatorial capitalism. From wealth insurers to defense contractors, and further joined at the hip to a White House that can find no better exemplification of its stewardship than the nomination of John Brennan, closely, tightly working together in a circle of secrecy so as to hide the practicality of how we engage daily in war and crimes, but at least not those of the liberal corporate class ever fear having that discussion. Norman Pollack, Counterpunch. Back in a moment.
Into the hearts of men who need more than they can. Did I feel so?
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. And by the way, we're going to open our calls now for you to... Oh, I'm just looking at the clock. Didn't realize how fast this hour went. Well, we'll have Talk Back to continue after our regular 55-minute program. You can call at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Last mention up, this is from Saskia Session. She says, drones over there, total surveillance over here. The massive surveillance system built up over the last 10 years is the domestic companion of overseas drones killings. The big story buried in all the commentary about the U.S. government's drone policy is that the old algorithm of the liberal state no longer works. Focusing on drones is almost a distraction if it weren't for the number of men, women, and children they have killed in only a few years. What we should focus on is the deeper condition that enables the drone policy and so much more, and that is the sharp increase in the unaccountable executive power, no matter what party is in power. I would agree with that. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Now, let's go to our talkback segment. 888-874-4888. And also, I'm going to give you the phone number for those of you who ever need to listen over the telephone. You might be out on a trip. You could be anywhere, on vacation, anywhere, and say, I want to check in, see what Gary's talking about. And here is the number that you would call in order to listen as millions upon millions of minutes are being listened to by tens of thousands of people. Number one right now in all of North America, South America, and Canada by you, people listening over the telephone. That number is 619-550-0869. 619-550-0869. Let's say hello to Lou Ann Panessi. Hi, Lou Ann.
Hello, Gary. Well, I have an email here and from someone. He says that he is a longtime listener. And he said his dad is a famous athlete, or he was a famous athlete. And he said, my dad basically lives on endorsements, and he signs memorabilia. And it's as if, you know, he's heard the same stories of the past over and over and over again. He goes over the same memories, you know, like that movie Groundhog Day, he says. And yet he's been listening for quite some time. He says, what is very interesting to me is that you never really live off of your reputation. He says, how is it that you stay on top? And he said, how is it that you wake up every day and create so intensely listening to your shows each day? I mean, it's not like you have a once-a-week show. You're on the air, you know, more than 6 days a week. So he says, and he's also impressed with the age range of your audience. So he says, How is it that you do that? And he also mentions here that it's also similar. It's not just about his dad. He says he listens, he watches little bits of Sean Hannity and O'Reilly, and then he looks at The Left and the Rachel Maddow shows. And he says he sees the same old, same old. He says they kind of have the same guests, it's the same message, the left demonizing the right demonizing the left, pointing fingers. And he says, and yet, from where he's sitting, based on all the shows that you've done and he's listened to intently, they're all off base. They're all missing the point. And, of course, his question to you is, how do you do it?
How do I do what? I'm not quite sure what the question is.
He wants to know is, how is it that you wake up every day and you're able to create your shows? How do you work so intensely without just living off your reputation?
About 20 years ago, I counseled a very famous and very loved rock and roll singer. And just a week after that, I saw him out in Nassau Coliseum when they must have had 30 acts. It was a wonderful day. And while we're sitting there and I'm going over his health issues and helping him, I asked him, I said, it's been so long since you've created, you know, a song. It's a hit. You had a lot of hits. I said, why is it? What happened? Now, I also had a chance to speak with another recording artist from about the same era, about a year later, and they both gave me the same answer. They said, when you're out there and you have a hit and you're constantly working to keep that up on the charts, and you have to travel, you have to do these tours, and it's all controlled by a producer. And then one day, someone comes into the producer's office that has something that sounds a little different, a different personality, and the producer says, well, we're going to make you the next hit. And he said, then you, this guy, no longer is getting the attention, because it takes a lot of effort to make a hit. You got to have a producer and arranger, and you have to, you know, it costs a lot of money. So those who have been popular, even though the audience still loves them and they still have all their talent, they're no longer given the opportunity. And they never made enough money to be able to do it on their own. So they live by going on these Golden Oldie shows. And he said it's on the one hand, it brings in some money and keeps you connected with your audience. And he said, but it's interesting because frequently when they'll put out a new record, even if they produce one themselves, nobody wants that. They came for the old. It could be 30 years. They want to hear that old song. And I have realized a long time ago how easily it is to control the creative process and mainly creative people. Being one of those creative people and having royalties stolen and having all kinds of lies. So I just decided, put myself in a position where I control my own destiny. And that's what I've done. So I can choose which books I want to write and publish, and I can do so as a partner with my publishers. I can choose what forms to work in. So you have to gain some control over your life. The trouble is, most people, when they have that opportunity, they think there's too much to learn, it's too hard, that they just want to be the talent, the artist, the sculptor, the dancer, the singer, the poet, whatever it is, and instead of becoming a part of it. So they control their future. Long ago, I would not have been able to sustain myself if I didn't do businesses like Health Food Store that would allow me an income in order to do the things I really had a passion for, as well as I succeed to help other people. It was John F. Kennedy who said, too often we enjoy the comfort of opinion without the discomfort of thought. And I believe that when you realize that you should not be limited. Who says you have to retire because you're 24 and a swimmer, or a gymnast at 22, or a golfer at 40, or a tennis player at 35, or a football player at 37? Who says? That's opinion. It takes someone to set aside opinion and say, I choose not to retire. I love the game. I'm going to continue. And then create a system that allows you to go through opinion and create a new world. Once one person does it, then all those other people say, well, I could do that too. And that's true with anything. You know, self-publishing, using the internet, which we didn't have before, but now we can and have. There's so many ways that we can stay relevant, stay current, stay topical, and most importantly, stay in control of our own lives. The more we give other people the right to control our destiny, the less destiny we're going to have work on our behalf. And probably the father who's now signing whatever memorabilia is signing probably prematurely retired. Why? Because for decades, the moment you were out of season, whether it's football, basketball, track, you just went back to normal eating and living and drinking and you got out of shape. Well, if every year you have to work for at least 3 months to get back into shape, and then you're in shape, and then you're out of shape again, you're just prematurely aging the body. What if you just kept in shape 12 months a year? So there's a whole new dynamic in our awareness. I believe that we should have some music collectives where you get independent producers and recording artists who work together with a group of people to write, you know, new music and to produce it and put it up on the internet. And to give people an extended or a whole new career. It's entirely doable. It just takes the imagination and getting out of the idea that you're no longer marketable. You're no longer, you know. Hey, remember Sylvester Stallone? For 15 years, he couldn't get arrested. And then he finally got the money to do Rocky, whatever it was, 5 or 6. And no one thought that would be anything other than a joke. It hadn't been a very good film. And it became a $100 million hit. And then 2 years later, he got enough money to do Rambo. And I thought that was his best Rambo. And again, that became an international hit. And then he got the money to do The Expendables. And that became a monster worldwide hit, $300 million. And then he did part two on that. So there's a person who fought to have another chance and recreated himself. Because at least he had some control over it. It's when we give up control over our lives and the decisions we make that we end up having very short success in our field. Thanks for the question. Let's say hello to Utrecht Lead. Hi, Utrecht.
Hi, Gary. Today I'm talking about a cab ride from hell that is a perfect metaphor for our political situation.
Oh, good. We look forward to it. Utrecht Lead, we're going to go on the cab ride to the dark side in a moment. Please stay with us.